Retina Rounds, podcast number 26. What is the role of scleral buckling in modern vitreoretinal surgery? In today's podcast, we're going to do something a bit different. We're thrilled to feature an interview performed by our friend and Retina Rounds contributor, Dr. David Perez Gonzalez. Dr. Gonzalez is a rising star in vitreoretinal surgery and the founder of EyeSight Academy, an up-and-coming online ophthalmic surgery education channel. In the podcast, Dr. Gonzalez and I discuss scleral buckling. Why is scleral buckling falling out of favor despite outstanding surgical outcomes? Which patients are the ideal candidates for a scleral buckle? And how can surgeons learn how to perform scleral buckles if they weren't exposed to this technique during fellowship training? We hope you find the discussion a useful adjunct to our ongoing series on scleral buckling, and if you haven't already, make sure to check out and subscribe to EyeSight Academy. Thank you, Dr. Perez Gonzalez, for sharing this interview with us.
Today, we're going to discuss something that I consider it's quite relevant, Dr. Pradeep, in your experience, which is the use of scleral buckling in retinal detachments. I do believe that scleral buckling with advancing vitrectomy technology has been, you know, laid out a little bit in the role of treatment for retinal detachment. So, what do you think it's now the, in your point of view, what do you think can be the relevance today for implement scleral buckling in treatment of retinal detachment for some young fellows, especially because I think that one of the most important problems is that in my fellowship, for example, I didn't perform too many scleral buckles. I start just using the vitrectomy, and with the advances with the small gauge vitrectomy, with high cut rates vitrectors and all that stuff, I think the buckle is a little bit behind in the use these days. So what can you tell me about this? What can I, you know, just enlighten me a little bit, because I have to be honest before keep going. I'm a little bit against the scleral buckle. I don't really like it, but I understand that it has a role in retinal detachments and in the management these days.
Yeah, look, I think that vitrectomy is all the technological innovation that's happening is really centered around vitrectomy platforms. There's not really been a whole lot of technological advancement with respect to scleral buckling. There are some exceptions to that. Dr. Rajiv Mooney is doing some really interesting things with visco buckles, so using viscoelastic agent in the suprachoroidal space to provide a temporary buckling element similar to Dr. Linkoff's balloons. So there is some innovation happening in this space, but when you think about what's happening in vitreoretinal surgery, it really all centers around vitrectomy. And so part of the, I think, the excitement around performing surgery is also centered around where the innovation is. And so, you know, admittedly, there's less innovation that's happening in the scleral buckling space. But what I would say is I think that there are a number of reasons that everybody should know how to do a scleral buckle, and there are a number of reasons why I think it's slowly, it's not being taught nearly as much as you alluded to in your own training. I didn't get as much exposure to scleral buckling. And just if you look at the performance patterns, at least in the United States, and I'm sure this is true globally, the use of scleral buckling has certainly diminished in favor of performing a vitrectomy. So I think let's start by saying, like, well, why would we want to do a scleral buckle, right? And who are the right candidates for a scleral buckle? And I would also point to the fact that scleral buckling has a very high success rate. In fact, if you look at scleral buckling outcomes and vitrectomy outcomes, they're comparable, if not buckling beating out vitrectomy in certain subsets of patients. And so I would definitely argue that buckling outcomes are a very big reason to incorporate that into your practice, but it's not necessarily the right procedure for every patient. So who would be the right candidate? Well, definitely patients who don't have a PVD. These are the patients where, and they tend to be younger patients, of course. These are the patients who I think are ideal candidates for a scleral buckle. Obviously, it can be difficult to induce a PVD surgically if you're performing a vitrectomy. There's a risk for iatrogenic retinal breaks. Oftentimes with younger patients, they tend to be phakic with a relatively clear lens, and so you circumvent the need for having cataract surgery performed earlier than it would have been needed otherwise. And so, you know, the prototypical patient is going to be someone who is young without a PVD and a relatively clear lens. There is a subset of patients where buckling is clearly the better approach than performing a vitrectomy, and that would be in a retinal dialysis. The outcomes for retinal dialyses are north of 98%, as opposed to certainly lower success rates with vitrectomy. And there's different types of buckles too. You know, there's primary buckling, and then there's adding on a buckle to a vitrectomy. The reasons why I think that buckling has sort of fallen out of favor a little bit is there are multiple reasons. One is it takes longer to perform compared to a vitrectomy. Oftentimes, these patients need to be either heavily sedated if it's done under local, which some surgeons do, and we do that in our institution, or general anesthesia. So there's certain risks associated with that. It really requires a very detailed, very good examination. And with the time pressures that I think, just dealing with the reality, ideally in a perfect world, every patient has a very thorough examination. The surgeon has a full understanding of all of the pathology, all of the nuances that may be encountered during the surgical intervention. In reality, I think that given the time pressures that a lot of retinal surgeons have, they may not have as much time to perform that thorough examination, not have all of the information that they need. And unfortunately, what often happens, and I've seen this with some fellows too, is that they'll say, well, we'll just figure it out intraoperatively, right? I don't need to know where all the breaks are. I'm going to have the surgical approach and I'll figure it out intraoperatively, which is really not a good idea. You really, as a surgeon, I think the most important thing is you have to understand the anatomy. Sadly, that's becoming harder and harder to accomplish because of some of the time pressure. So that there's a component there. And then there's a financial piece of the surgery too. So it takes longer to perform, generally speaking, than a vitrectomy. And also the reimbursement or the payment associated with performing a scleral buckle is less than performing a vitrectomy. Now, I would hope that most vitreoretinal surgeons wouldn't make their decisions based on financial considerations. It should really be based on the patient's anatomy, the whole picture of the patient. What's best for the patient really should come first. But the sad reality is that there are some, those financial considerations are also, you know, they play a role. Not necessarily, I think, so much as how much a surgeon might get paid for a surgery, but really more of the time that's required to perform the surgery. So I think those are all reasons why buckling has fallen out of favor. Suffice it to say that buckling is, there's a little bit more of an art to scleral buckling than...
You were saying that technically it's a little bit more complicated than just a vitrectomy, I think.
It can be. It takes a lot of reps to get really comfortable. As with anything in surgery, it takes reps. And if you're not doing it during training, you're probably not going to be doing it as much after training. Because we want to do what we think is going to give our patients the best outcome in our own hands. And so if we're not trained to do a scleral buckle or don't have enough experience with it, we're probably not likely going to reach for that as a therapeutic option for surgical repair of retinal detachment. So I think those are all the reasons why buckling maybe has fallen a little bit or slowly is falling out of favor. I think I've already outlined the patients in whom I think buckling would be a good idea. There are also patients in whom buckling may not be a good idea, as patients who have significant media opacity where it's precluding you from being able to understand where all the breaks are, the entire anatomy. Patients who have significant pre-retinal membranes and that traction is going to interfere with the ability to successfully reattach the retina. And that would require an intraocular approach with a vitrectomy. There may be patients where the outcome is probably going to be the same if you do a buckle versus a vitrectomy. A pseudophakic patient with a single superior break, you know, it makes perfect sense to perform a vitrectomy. It's going to be faster for the patient. It's, you know, there's a lot of advantages to performing a vitrectomy in that type of situation. So I'm not saying that buckling is the right answer for every patient. It's certainly not the case. But it is a very critical tool in the toolbox that I think every surgeon should be comfortable with. And I'm sure we'll talk about different buckles. There's different strategies for performing scleral buckling, right? So there's the traditional primary scleral buckle, and that's going to be typically a silicone element that's going to have usually some encircling component to it, right? So I often use a 276 tire, which is a wider 7mm wide element that has a 240 band that's an encircling element to hold everything in place. So it gives me some support to the vitreous-based 360, but the wider tire is really where I'm targeting the pathology, where the break is, or where the breaks are. And I really like that in my hands. But there, I have colleagues who prefer just to perform an encircling band, and that's it. And there's many different bands of different heights and widths. So there's different strategies when performing a buckle. And then on top of that, you have sponges, which can be circumferentially placed. They can be just in a specific quadrant, and they can also be radially oriented. I will say to the patients who may not be a good candidate for a scleral buckle are those who have posterior breaks, where it may be more challenging to get a buckling element to actually support that area. So all of these things are reasons why if you don't get enough experience performing buckles, you're never going to be able to feel comfortable incorporating it into your practice.
Yeah, from my point of view, I think that doing what I learned in my fellowship is not that I think that I didn't get too much exposure to do scleral buckle. I did some scleral buckles, not as much as vitrectomy, for example. But I do believe that recently what I'm not agree with is that in many centers or in many areas of my country, for example, they sometimes insist to perform, for example, always combined procedure like a vitrectomy plus buckle, because we have seen some trials that compare the effectiveness of retinal reattachment, and it's more efficient, to be honest. I mean, if we see the numbers, the raw numbers of the results, the reattachment probability to do just single vitrectomy versus single buckle versus vitrectomy and buckle, I think it's better doing combined. But I do believe that some cases, as you mentioned, can benefit, and the trauma and the time and everything around the fact of deciding to apply a scleral buckle, it will be just better with doing a fake vitrectomy or just a vitrectomy itself. In my opinion, I don't think that doing a scleral buckle just because it won't be a re-detachment, it can be the answer to every patient, and that's why I'm not against the buckle, but against to do buckle in every case. Because in my experience also, I'm not so handy on in scleral buckles, because as I mentioned, I didn't perform a lot of scleral buckles. So that's my point of view. And another dilemma that I want to ask you about is, what do you think when the main component of a retinal detachment, we have seen some different scenarios. For example, you mentioned if there is a PVD, if there is not a PVD, there are some retinal detachment without PVD, and that they have like round holes without significant traction. I think these cases can benefit more from a combined procedure or a scleral buckle. But the patients that already have a lot of vitreous traction in the periphery, such as, horse or tears and all that stuff, I think can benefit more from releasing that traction mechanically by doing a vitrectomy. So I do believe that once that you perform a very good vitrectomy, and by doing good a vitrectomy, it means that shaving very good the vitreous base and do a 100% vitrectomy as much as you can to release all the traction. I do believe, and I still believe, that vitrectomy can be very good in the armamentarium against a scleral buckle. And there is another dilemma about the inferior breaks. What do you think about this? Because some protocols of deciding when to put a scleral buckle and where not to use it is, if I have a patient with a regmatogenous retinal detachment, but it has inferior breaks, I would do prefer to add a scleral buckle in my surgery. Do you think that this can be relevant, not relevant?
Yeah, absolutely, I think it's relevant. And going to your earlier point, I 100% agree with you that there will never be a one-size-fits-all approach to treating or repairing a retinal detachment. You always have to take into account all the different factors with respect to the patient, their anatomy, other factors. Are they likely to position properly or not? Do they live at an elevation or not? I mean, there's a variety of different factors. What's the status of the fellow eye? There's a lot of different things that need to be taken into account to decide what is going to be the best approach for an individual patient. And the problem with a lot of surgical studies is that there's so much heterogeneity in pathology and surgical skill and comfort level between different surgeons. It's very hard to have a good understanding of what the best approach is. I think the PRO study, which is what you were sort of alluding to earlier, has given us a lot of insights into how we can treat rental detachments. And you're right, the addition of a scleral buckle when performing a vitrectomy can significantly increase success rates. Is that the right thing for every patient? No, I don't think so. I don't think it's necessary. But I do like to answer your question about inferior pathology, I do like to put on a band for patients who have inferior pathology. But even then, not all inferior pathology is the same. If I have a patient who has a single horseshoe break, let's just say in their right eye at, say the 8 o'clock clock hour position, that is inferior to the horizontal meridian, but they can do just fine with just a primary vitrectomy in the pseudophakic eye, primary vitrectomy in position on their side. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Generally speaking, my approach is to put on an encircling band when performing a vitrectomy in patients who have inferior pathology. Not always a case, but generally that's what I do. If I'm at all concerned about PVR, either if it's present already or if the patient is at high risk for PVR, for example, a patient who's got a history of inflammation or they've got trauma or some other reason, maybe significant vitreous hemorrhage, these are all things that may sway me towards adding on an encircling band rather than just performing a primary vitrectomy.
What do you think about if you already have a patient with a chronic retinal detachment, a young patient? I had a case. I will tell you about this case because it caused me a lot of trouble emotionally. A younger patient, 36-year-old, a female patient. It came to my office with 6 months after decreasing vision in one of the eyes, in the right eye. And it was an inferior bullous retinogenous retinal detachment. You know, in these patients, when you have a very adherent posterior alloid, it's very difficult to induce a PVD. But this patient has already started to develop some PVR. So my first approach was to perform just vitrectomy and scleral buckle. I didn't want to remove the crystalline lens. But eventually the patient, after 1 or 2 months, I don't remember, I think it was 2 months after the initial surgery, she developed a strong PVR with a lot of contraction inferiorly. And eventually the retina detached again, even with the scleral buckle. So I did again the surgery. At this point, I performed a phaco vitrectomy because, after second vitrectomy, the risk to develop a posterior capsule opacification in this eye and develop cataract earlier, it was very high. So I removed the crystalline lens to perform a better shaving of the retina. And I decided to perform a retinectomy. So after this, I applied silicone and everything went stable as today. But my point is, if you have these patients with chronic retinal detachment, inferior detachments, wouldn't it be better to perform just initially vitrectomy, retinectomy, and silicone, and that's it, end of the case? Because, you know, we in my mind, I was programmed like, I know he's a younger patient, try to preserve the crystalline lens, you will not be able to shave very efficiently all the periphery, and it's an inferior retinal detachment. You know, it has all the pro factors initially for a scleral buckle or to consider to apply a scleral buckle, but even with the scleral buckle, the retina just fall apart anyway. And it cost me a lot of my coronaries, you know, during the scleral buckle, because it was a very complicated case, honestly. The eye, the space was very small. It was complicated. The patient was with high blood pressure during all the procedure. I mean, I wish and I would love to do it faster than take me maybe the 35, 40 minutes in the buckle plus the vitrectomy plus all the stuffs in the surgery. So I don't know, what is your standpoint for these cases where you have a chronic retinal detachment in a young patient? Would you consider to apply a scleral buckle, or you just avoid it and go straightforward to vitrectomy and maybe just peel the ILM or do whatever you want into the eye? But I don't know if the scleral buckle really, really put a difference in these cases. I'm not pretty sure.
Yeah, I would actually make an argument for a buckle in this type of a patient. So I've definitely seen plenty of inferior RDs in young patients who have still an attached hyoid, and going into these eyes can precipitate this very vicious cycle that you just described. And It's not an uncommon problem, and they're very disheartening for the patient and, of course, for the surgeon. But performing a scleral buckle in these eyes can be very, very powerful because they can have an excellent postoperative outcome. You don't touch anything inside of the eye, so you don't start to sort of instigate the PBR cascade. And the chronicity doesn't matter to me. The degree of bolus fluid doesn't matter to me. If I know where the breaks are and I can support it with a scleral buckle and there's not so much PBR on the preretinal surface that it will interfere with, I think, the reattachment of the retina, then I think performing a primary buckle is actually the best approach for this type of a patient. And I would also mention that not all PBR is the same. There's a lot of patients who have chronic retinal detachments who have subretinal PBR. And as you know, even in a vitrectomy, you don't always have to go after these subretinal bands. You can often leave them alone. And so in patients who have even subretinal bands, I'm still not dissuaded from performing a scleral buckle in these eyes because they can actually do very, very well. I'd need more information, of course, about the specific details of the detachment to opine on your particular case, but generally speaking, that's my first approach, actually, is to try with the scleral buckle. And if that fails, of course, then one has to move on to performing a vitrectomy. And I've shown videos on our platform, and everybody has experiences. The buckle doesn't always work. Of course, it's not 100%. But it's probably the best first step for a patient with a chronic retinal detachment. And then you can decide, you know, what additional surgery.
Interesting. I will think the opposite. You know, I will think the opposite because in some literature it's clearly said like avoid scleral buckle in PBR. You know, but as you mentioned, it's individualized in every patient. Not every PBR is the same in every patient. You know, so it can respond differently. And so, talking about just. You have a patient and you just decide to apply the scleral buckle. What do you think about doing it with chandelier? I've seen some cases where they use the, you know, the Resight vision or the biome, and then they put the chandelier and then they put the scleral buckle, and then they use the chandelier to identify a little bit much better the areas where the indentation needs to be done when they're placing the buckle, and especially when they are. I don't know if you already, if you're still doing it, but in my fellowship, that it was not long ago, they use cryotherapy to close the breaks before applying the buckle. And the, you see perfectly clear using the chandelier where you're applying the cryo. So what is your approach in these cases where you, when you use a single scleral buckle technique without vitrectomy? You advocate for a chandelier because many surgeons will go against this because, you know, you're entering the eye, so you're just putting the buckle, you just do the endovitrectomy, you're going into the eye with the chandelier. So what do you think about this approach with the chandelier or not chandelier? What is your approach when you just apply a single scleral buckle without vitrectomy?
Well, it's a great question about the chandelier buckle. I think that, so in my own hands, I don't use it routinely. And the reason is because I actually had a case where I put in a chandelier, and through that trocar, I actually got vitreous incarceration, and that resulted in vitreoretinal traction and the surgery failed. So I generally don't like to. I don't find that my visualization is hampered by putting on an indirect. I can see things just fine with the indirect ophthalmoscope. That's how I examine patients in the clinic, and I've done the vast majority of my buckling cases with just an indirect. The value, I think, is where if you're in a teaching hospital and for this, for the fellow surgeon or the other the trainee surgeons in the room to be able to see the same thing that you're seeing, right? So it's hard to give guidance, for example, for my fellows, it's very hard to give guidance to them regarding how intensive cryotherapy is appropriate, right? You don't want a big freeze ball inside of the eye when applying cryo, and I can only describe that, but with a chandelier, I can actually show this is how much cryo needs to be applied, this is where the cryo needs to be applied. So there's a lot of value, I think, from a teaching perspective to have that approach. There's some ergonomic considerations too. It's you're just using a microscope or a heads-up display, just as you would with a regular surgery, and so it may be easier on the body long term. The last thing is it's less cumbersome to use a chandelier because you're not taking, you know, having to put on some sort of a bag or some sort of covering for your gloves, risk for contamination. You're going back and forth during multiple steps of the surgery. So the logistics are a little bit smoother when using a chandelier. But in my hands, I find that just using a biofilmoscope is just an indirect.
And you're still using cryo for closing the retinal breaks?
Yes, for the most part, exactly. There's subretinal fluid that's there, so I'll apply the cryotherapy before I drain. Certainly, you could consider draining the subretinal fluid with the buckle in place, and then if the retina happens to be reopposed, you can apply laser. But there's plenty of times where even after what I thought was going to be a complete subretinal fluid drainage, that there's still a significant amount of subretinal fluid that remains in the eye. So I definitely perform cryotherapy. The steps of my surgery are after I've isolated the rectus muscles, I've marked the break. I've marked not only where the break or breaks are, I've also marked where I'd like to drain the subretinal fluid. And then I'll apply cryotherapy, pre-place my scleral buckle, and then I like to drain subretinal fluid. So I'll perform a scleral cutdown, drain the subretinal fluid. I don't drain in cases where there's very shallow subretinal fluid, where it's not necessary. But for cases where there's significant subretinal fluid, where I don't think I'm going to get good apposition of the inner sensory retina, the underlying RPE, I'll drain that subretinal fluid, and then that'll complete the case for me. Of course, closing the conjunctiva and all of that. So cryotherapy is still the mainstay of treatment for me for when I'm performing well.
Amazing. Yeah. That's what I saw in my fellowship also. They were doing cryo in all the scleral buckles to close the breaks first and then to apply the buckle. Unless they will do a combined procedure with vitrectomy, of course, they will not do that, right? But draining fluid, I didn't see it too often. I think scleral buckle is an amazing technique, but it still is like a very interesting art to do in the eye. You know, you need to know very good the anatomy. You need to be very patient. You need to planify it a lot, as you mentioned, before decide to put or not a scleral band. And regarding that fact, I think that the technique that you use to apply the, for example, an encircling band, 360 encircling band, I learned to do it with sutures. But there are some other techniques like using, scleral flaps that they just pass the band through the scleral flap. And then it's faster, of course. It's easier, in my opinion. But I don't know if what I have seen in this technique is that sometimes you can control the quadrant of indentation that you really want to, where you really want to do more pressure. You just indent 360 degrees equally with the scleral flaps. So what is your approach in these cases? You prefer to use sutures, or would you consider to use scleral flaps? What do you think about this other technique?
So what I'll say as far as my approach is, I use sutures. I don't create scleral tunnels or scleral flaps. And there's two reasons for that. And you alluded to one of them, which is how you're going to get the height of your scleral buckle, right? There's two ways in which you can achieve that. You can do that through an imbricating effect. So you'll use sutures to anteroposteriorly shorten the eye. That can result in a very high, very prominent buckling effect. And then you can also tighten the band. So it's like tightening your belt, and that can also achieve some height. And it depends on what you're trying to achieve. I usually use a segmental element that is wider. I mentioned the 276. That's kind of my go-to scleral buckle. So I'm using imbricating sutures in that quadrant where I have the wider tire, and then standard mattress sutures in the remaining quadrants just to hold the encircling band in place. But the reason I don't like to use the partial thickness scleral flaps or the scleral tunnels is because, first of all, if you're not careful, I've seen plenty of cases where the dissection is too deep and then a big choroidal hemorrhage can develop. I've seen that plenty of times with my fellows sharing those types of cases. So I generally just don't like that approach. I've found that I feel very comfortable placing partial thickness suture bites to hold the buckle in place. I think that sometimes also depending on the type of element that you're using in a primary buckle, you may want to reposition the buckle. And so you can't do that when you've created a scleral flap. So the nice thing about sutures is that if you're not satisfied with the imbrication, you're not satisfied with the location, you can take out the sutures and then replace the buckle in the location that you would like. And so it gives you a little bit more flexibility in that regard. So for those reasons, I generally I prefer using sutures. And there's different suture materials, of course, that one can use. I usually use Marceline suture for my buckles, but some people really like nylon sutures. I don't think that the suture material itself matters so much, but using the suture, I think, is in my hands a bit safer and more, it gives me more flexibility.
I would love to see one of your scleral buckles in retina rounds. your technique.
Sure.
I know it's difficult because, if you're not using the chandelier, for example, technique or the microscope to fix the buckle, it's difficult to obtain the video, but I would love to see it. Because for me, I think it's starting to become a lost art to manage properly a scleral buckle, as you mentioned, you know, this kind of touch, slightly touch that, no, I don't like this imbricating area. I would like to lose the sutures in this port and so on. It takes a lot of patience and a lot of, being very meticulous that I didn't learn in that way, to be honest with you.
You're absolutely right. Patience is actually very, very important with scleral buckling. It does take a little bit more time. And another area where patience is really required is in the postoperative period. Because as I said, especially in younger patients, the subretinal fluid is this liquefied vitreous is thicker. It can be slower to go away. Sometimes the fluid can shift. And so you have to be patient in the postoperative period as you monitor patients. If there is still some subretinal fluid, that can just go away with time. And serial imaging can be really helpful to be able to objectively determine whether the subretinal fluid is in fact going away. One thing I would say with scleral buckling that I know with a great deal of confidence, either at the end of the surgery or definitely by postoperative day one, I'll know whether it's worked. And the fact that the patient doesn't generally need to position or do anything like that, I think that's a huge pro to scleral buckling that we don't have with vitrectomy. A very smooth vitrectomy, PVR can rear its ugly head. Post-op month one, post-op month two, and so you never really feel like you're out of the woods until you clear those hurdles. Whereas with the buckle, I feel like I really have a high degree of confidence in the majority of cases that it's worked at the end of the surgery or at least by post-op day one.
Yeah, and the other thing that I see with buckle is that I need to review again the literature, but I think that the retinal translocation is not so common as with vitrectomy in these cases. So I think the functionality and the best corrected visual acuity, I think, can be better with just the scleral buckle without vitrectomy. That's what I have
seen.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. So again, bringing up Rajiv Mooney's group, they've done a lot of really great work looking at how the retina reattaches. And with a pneumatic, for example, or even if you're doing a vitrectomy or a buckle and there's some residual subretinal fluid, letting the body take care of that subretinal fluid on its own can result in better anatomic outcomes, less macular translocation, as you mentioned, less stretching of the retina, which can result in visual distortions. The one caveat to that is if you are draining subretinal fluid and you're reconstituting volume in the vitreous cavity, if you've got for example, a superior supratemporal retinal detachment, if it involves or is encroaching on the macula, and you don't drain that fluid, and you put in, for example, an advanced cell gas bubble, sometimes that can actually be a setup for a macular fold or translocation. That was, I think, one of the earlier episodes that we had on retina rounds was a case where we had to deal with that postoperatively. And so it can still happen, but I think you're right, to a much lesser extent than reattaching a retina with perfluorocarbon liquid, flattening everything out. You're not guaranteed that the way that you've steamrolled that retina flat is going to be the way that it once was, or that the macula won't be stretched in such a way that you can avoid the postoperative retinal apopsia. So I agree that it's lower risk.
Yeah, of course. Sure, I think that another interesting top that can be like a pneumatic retinopexy, right? Now it's in vogue in every congress. They are mentioned that there are some works that they are doing even pneumatic retinopexy in inferior breaks and chronic retinal detachment and so on. But I think that's another story. But I don't want to take more of your time. I just want to ask you one of the few last questions, or even maybe the last question. But what advice can give me or give young retina specialists who didn't get and probably will not get enough exposure to scleral buckling to don't lose this vivacity to continue using it or considering it in some cases, and especially to don't lose the patience to decide whether to put or not to put the scleral buckle in the patients? Because sometimes the confronting zone, talking by myself, I'm not talking about anyone else, but what I face sometimes when I decide to put a scleral buckle is that, scleral buckle. It's like it would take more time. I don't want to take more time in the surgery. You know, it's like it's another rock in the back that you don't want to put or you don't want to use. So what advice will give the young residents or the young fellows or the young retina specialists, that because it's very difficult to get the right number of you know, to learn very good the learning curve of scleral buckling after you finish your fellowship by yourself? It's very difficult to get this. So if you didn't have 2 months exposure in your fellowship, it would be very hard to learn it right by your own, in my opinion. It's not that you cannot do it, but I think it's going to be difficult. So what advice will you give to your retina specialist to keep going or not lose the faith in scleral buckling to do it? How we can keep learning how to put it, how to use it?
That's a great question. And so I would encourage all vitreoretinal surgeons to embrace the fact that this is a career of lifelong learning. Small gauge surgery, I when I was a fellow, I was doing 20 gauge vitrectomy. And so, you know, I had to learn how to perform, you know, small gauge surgery. It's not that it was a big leap, but it was a new skill set that I had to learn. There are certain techniques that I've learned along the way that I wasn't trained on how to do, but you should be motivated to learn these techniques because it's right for the patient. Right, to be able to deliver the best possible care for a patient. And we've outlined already the ideal candidates for a scleral buckle. So what can you do if you want to perform a scleral buckle? I would say, so choosing the right patient is key, right? You don't want for your first patient to be somebody who's got breaks in multiple quadrants, anterior and posterior breaks that are going to be hard to cover with a single element or with a combination of an encircling band and a tire. So choose a patient where the location of the break is easy to access. So, for example, somebody who's got a single superior supraotemporal or a single infrotemporal break that's easy to access would be a good starting point. A break that's not too big, ideally. And then I would also probably, you know, there's an argument to be made to start with a simpler buckle that's easy to put on, like an encircling band. And there's different encircling bands. Generally speaking, I'll use a 40-50 encircling element, but there's also a broader element called an S40-50 band, which is can provide a sort of a wider coverage of a retinal break, and it doesn't have a very high profile. It's pretty easy to put on. So maybe start with putting on a simple buckle. But there's also an argument to be made to try something that maybe takes a little bit longer, but is very forgiving, and that's that 276 tire I was telling you about earlier. So the 276 tire is very wide; it's 7 millimeters. Sutures have to be 9 millimeters apart anteroposteriorly, so it's a little bit more challenging to put on. But because of that, how broad that buckle is, very forgiving, so you don't have to hit. You don't have to get it centered on the break just right. You always want to have it well positioned on the break, but because it's so wide, you can pretty much cover most. If you just put it in that correct quadrant, you're probably going to be able to cover the break, and it has a very high success rate. So, you know, there's an argument to be made both ways, but I think most people will probably opt to perform an encircling band. Certainly, I think most surgeons feel comfortable doing that. If they're performing vitrectomies, they should know how to do a buckle under vitrectomy, and they're putting an encircling band in those cases. So doing a buckle, for a primary buckle using an encircling band technically will not be very difficult. But choosing the right case, I think, is important. And, you know, depending on your practice, some practices may have some senior surgeons who feel very comfortable with performing buckling. And if you're maybe a junior surgeon in a practice, in a group practice, or you have maybe a colleague in the area who has a little bit more experience, there's nothing wrong with asking a colleague, whether it's in your own practice or somewhere else, to maybe scrub with you on a case and just show you how to do it. I think most people would feel honored to be able to help a colleague, especially in their own practice or even a colleague in a different practice, to learn a new technique that they may not feel totally comfortable with. And so don't feel shy to ask for help. And then last, of course, surgical videos. And David, your point is well taken. I'll make sure to have more videos on retina rounds to show the finer points of scleral buckling. But surgical videos, surgical conferences where they talk about buckling. Most of the cases are vitrectomies, but every once in a while you have a buckle. And so those can be really valuable as well.
Yeah, of course. Of course, of course, of course. I really hope to see that video on retina rounds soon. If I can record one, I definitely will share with you in your channel. I think you're doing an amazing job in retina rounds. I really follow many videos that you have performed, and I do believe that some of that videos can be considered by some mentors or some other seniors like quite of irrelevance. For example, I saw one of your videos, how to prepare or set your constellation machine. It's something that it's very basic, but sometimes they don't teach us how to do it, you know? And it's amazing that we can find out on the internet right now in your channel. Hey, I don't remember how to. One day maybe you are alone and you don't have an assistant nurse or an assistant physician that can set up the machines for you, and that's amazing. So for every other video that you put in your channel, I think you bestow a lot of information and a lot of confidence to young retina specialists like myself. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing together with Professor Dave Debgan. It's just amazing.
Well, thank you very much for those very, very kind words. And I would say that, David, you're part of Retina Rounds. You've been a contributor for a couple of videos, and they've been fantastic. And that's what I love about the platform, is that it's not just one person who's showing their surgeries. It is a community of retina specialists who can share techniques. Sometimes things go well and sometimes things don't go well, but we can all, when we are learning from each other, we can incorporate some best practices and maybe avoid some pitfalls based on our own experience and those of our fellow surgeons. So, it's definitely a labor of love. Your channel too, as you know, you put in a lot of time and effort for your channel, and there's a tremendous amount of educational value. Now with so many more surgeons being able to record their surgeries, we have, and these newer platforms, we have ways in which we can disseminate information in ways we just didn't when I was a fellow. And so what we're trying to do here, I think, not just Retina Rounds, but as sort of a community of online educators in the space, is to try to break down these silos of information. So what I have gleaned from my mentors along the way, I can share that with everybody. You don't have to train at any one institution. You can sort of benefit from the edge of knowledge and education of the community. And so just keep going, and the more channels, the better. I think the more people that are involved in the space, the better. It's better for our trainees. And I will say too that I've got plenty of emails and comments from people who are seasoned surgeons who find it to be helpful. You mentioned the setting up the constellation video, but there's something as basic as that, it's nice to have it. You know, it's just it's not something you have to reach for all the time, but when you need it, it's nice to know that there's these types of resources that are readily available to help you along the way.
That's right. Yeah, and I will keep contributing as much as I can with the Retina Rounds. I will send you as much videos as I can. It takes time, as you know, to edit the videos and, you know, choose the right one. Sometimes you record the video in surgery and it turns out that it was not so good. So you try to find the right video where you show really either the complication that you have or something that you would like to share. So being said that, Dr. Brady, thank you very much for sharing your insights with me and for all the listeners in this platform today. I think that the real takeaway I write it down here and I will share it with you. I think that rather than framing it as vitrectomy versus buckle, as many articles are doing today, or many protocols, like, let's see what's better, if vitrectomy or buckle. I think it's not about the versus one against the other. I think we should think in terms of matching the right tool for the right patient. I think that's the key tool or the takeaway that I'm learning from you today here in this conversation. I think that preserving a full surgical repertoire for the benefit of those we treat is the best we can do. So I think that it's not about leave behind the old, but use the best of both worlds. We have vitrectomy today. We have buckle today. Before vitrectomy, we only used to have buckle. That's why we used to apply the buckle before, but now we have vitrectomy. And I think that having that, both sides of both worlds can benefit a lot with our patients, but choosing the right one for the right patient, I think it's the best takeaway that you mentioned today. So thank you very much for sharing that with me. It has been an honor to have you here and have this conversation with you today.
Thanks so much, David. And I couldn't agree more. I think that we always have to approach our patients as the individual in front of us. Clinical trials, research, a variety of research papers and studies can help guide us in our decision making. But ultimately, the beauty of being a physician is that, a surgeon, is that you get to choose what you think is going to be the best. And you always have to make that tailored decision for the patient in front of you. So thanks for having me. Keep up all the great work. I look forward to collaborating more in the future.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.